5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The dark side of the Huddle Moon. Immutably amazing crypto wisdom. On this lunar focused crypto currently, we discuss Obamagate and government surveillance in the US. Interesting Ethereum 2.0 progress updates, YouTube censoring more crypto content, and Bitcoin investing news with Paul Tudor Jones II, and why Max Keiser thinks Warren Buffett has damaged his reputation by not investing. We discuss Bitcoin as gold 2.0, and Plan B's very interesting new stock-to-flow cross-asset model. We hear about a new global Bitcoin mining power tracking tool, how you can download a Bitcoin node from space, Bitcoin Cash dominance in the peer-to-peer cash ecosystem in Australia, and crazy Craig Wright plagiarizing parts of his PhD thesis. You are now in geosynchronous orbit over the dark side of the Huddle Moon.
Copy. This show is proudly sponsored by Salamantech's point-of-sale devices and software. Tired of all the headaches dealing with cryptocurrency? You don't know what a private key is? You don't want to deal with exchanges? Well, if you're a business and you just want to run your business without thinking about cryptocurrency headaches, look no further than Salamantechs. We provide point-of-sale software that allows you to get paid in fiat currency, that's euros, allowing your customers to pay in cryptocurrency, that's BTC, ETH, and a host of others.
Dark Side of the Huddle Moon proudly uses the audio services of Eye the Sound. Beyond the amazing sound production, they've really been a sounding board, pun intended, for our show, giving us great customer support and constructive criticism and feedback. So if you want a little bit more personalized attention you're not going to get from a bigger provider, check out iTheSound.com. And we're back with another lunar mission on Dark Side of the Huddle Moon. I'm Blockade, aka the Huddle Model. I'm here with Josh. Josh, how are you today?
Doing well, Kate. I'm having a great day today. Honestly, I'm thinking that in 30 days' time, the Bitcoin price is going to be through the roof. The prediction is going to be released later at the end of this show.
Nice. And I'm going to make another prediction. I'm going to make a different prediction. I'm going to make it right now. In 30 days, the HODL model will still be HODLing.
Well, yeah. Okay. That's not a prediction. That's a guarantee. That's a steadfast fact. So today we're going to talk about a bunch of hot topics from the crypto world. Obviously, the halving has just happened a few days ago. And you know, that feeds into my prediction later.
Yeah, definitely. Well, everyone else talks about the halving, so let's go off the blockchain a little bit, talk about some other things. But yeah, for me, the halving was kind of a non-event because I'm not a miner. You know, a lot of people are arguing, is it priced in? Is it not priced in? You know, can it be priced in? And obviously after the fact, you know, we're just looking back and talking about it. I made some predictions and some of them were right, some of them weren't. But for me, it's just another event. I think if you're a miner, obviously you got to pay attention. We're going to see, like, are we going to see that miner capitulation or not? It doesn't seem like we are, but only time will tell. But, you know, with the stock to flow and what that means for people that have Bitcoin, I think it's looking like a bright future. But we've been talking a lot about the coronavirus and the pandemic and the lockdowns, you know, between us and with our guests. So I thought today we'd talk about something a little bit different. And what's recently popping off, at least in the US, is, you know, Obamagate is trending. And it seems like the previous administration was doing some pretty shady stuff, spying on, you know, the other campaign, which eventually won. And this stuff is all kind of leaking out now. And it seems like the Russiagate thing was just like, you know, just a diversion. You know, the best defense is a good offense sometimes. It seems like the Russiagate thing was a complete, as some say, would say, nothing burger. And now it seems like, you know, it's hitting people too, because Biden was in the former administration and he's getting tied up in it too. It looks like he was spying on Trump and he was a big part of it. And now he's going to be running against Trump. So it doesn't look good. And it's a big scandal. I think whether you're pro-Trump, anti-Trump, left, right, or you're more up like me, a little bit more libertarian, minarchist, freedom orientated, you know, everyone in my friend and family group that's even mildly political is talking about it. And everyone's kind of shocked, you know. Obama did have scandals. They weren't mentioned a lot in the mainstream media, but this is going to be the scandal of all scandals, to be spying on your opponent or your political enemy prior to an election. And this makes Watergate look like nothing. And, you know, I don't want to say too much. We could talk about it later when more info comes out, but it doesn't look good.
Well, from my perspective in South Korea, I've only seen like very few reports about this. Obviously, the focus is on what's happening inside the country. But I have had the chance to read a few articles about it. I'm sure that they have some type of defense prepared for this. They could say it's opposition research or something euphemistic like that. But yes, the Russian thing was always going to be a nothing burger, and CNN confirmed that as well. So now it's coming out that Obama seems to have had a hand in trying to dig up some dirt on Trump and using government resources to do so.
Yeah, they were wiretapping, listening to him in real time. It was pretty crazy. That's how the leaks were happening, is because they were listening to every single thing they were saying through email and through calls.
Yeah, and then you've got to remember, his opponent at the time, Hillary Clinton, was also like, I just still don't know how this hasn't reached like its conclusion. She deleted like tons of emails. She had a private server running in her own house, which is technically illegal, but yet she was still allowed to run. I don't quite understand it. So yeah, it does seem like there was some high level stuff going on at the time. Trump eventually won, and like I've said before, I mean, Trump's the master of media manipulation in terms of getting the media to talk about stuff that he wants them to talk about, even if it means he has to kind of mislead them a little bit at the start. We've talked about this before. The Dilbert Cartoons guy, Scott Adams, talks about this in his book, How to Win Bigly. And Trump knows what he's doing. He's not an idiot, despite what people would love to wish that he was. He won the presidency of the United States as a non-politician, the first person to ever do that in history. He ran it, he won it spending less than half the amount of money as his opponent, who already had the credentials and the name, the Clinton name. And he was a great success in terms of winning and galvanizing his support, despite like lots of mainstream media harsh criticism. So when he is confident enough to basically start goading the other side, because he's started to put out memes on his own Instagram and social media, and he's putting out,
they're going to try and fact check him.
Like, I'm going to investigate you and that type of thing. It's not going to end well for Obama and friends, honestly, because if he's that confident to start doing that, I mean, the track record already speaks for itself. He's the meme warrior.
Yeah.
So once he starts putting memes out, then it's game over.
Yeah. Oh, I think he can put out memes that are truthful, or like, as Scott M says, likes to say, there's some truthiness. At least it's airs towards the truth. And they're gonna try and fact check him, or people that disagree with him are gonna try and fact check him. They're gonna find out, whoa, what he's saying is kind of accurate. And exactly. the one thing I hate about, you know, we've talked about this with our interview with Roger Ver and other people, I hate it. You can't say two things that are completely the opposite. You know, is Trump a secret Russian double agent genius, or is he an idiot? He can't be both. So we've seen some media people say he's a super evil genius who has managed to keep his connections to Russia hidden for 3 years, or he's a complete moron. And I tend to think, you know, like any person that's rational, he's obviously much smarter than the average person. But you can't say both those things. If you say both those things, you look like a complete idiot. But I kind of want to tie it back to what you said before about Hillary not really facing repercussions. And Obama is the former president. So there's almost like an unwritten rule that you don't go after the former president, even though it seems like it's possible to do. You know, Obama didn't go after George W. Bush, and some people said he should have went after him for war crimes and stuff like that. But it kind of makes me think about how we talk about some banks. The banks are too big to fail. So some people think some people are just too big to jail. You know, if you're Hillary or Obama, you know, short of, you know, murdering someone and having it on camera, you're just not going to get taken down because you're just too big of a person with too many connections, and the political reverberations would be too great. So I think like they get a really, really long leash and they can almost do whatever they want because they know that no one's going to go after them.
Well, that makes sense. And well, this also ties in with other stuff like the Epstein thing. A lot of people don't really think that he necessarily killed himself. So we don't want to go into the conspiracy side too much on the dark side of the Hollow Moon. But all of these things, when you think about them together, they kind of don't seem to add up. You've got a financial system where you've just printed a ton of money and it's not based on anything but faith. Surely that faith will be eroded in the long run, especially as the people, the elites that are supposedly running society, well, the emperor has no clothes at some point. So I think people like Trump are helping to expose that a little bit. Of course, there are people on the other side of the political aisle that are absolutely having none of this, and they think that Obamagate is just a big distraction by Trump to distract from the coronavirus deaths that are happening. But it's not like Trump didn't try to close the borders very early on, and the media was like, racist Trump at it again. I mean, there's no way that he can win sometimes with these guys, to be fair.
Yeah.
So I can understand his fake news position when he just says, look, you're on fake news, I'm tired of it.
Well,
but it doesn't mean I necessarily buy everything he says, but like you mentioned, it's got truthfulness to it, or truthliness. What phrase did Scott Adams say?
I think he says truthiness. We'll try and get him on the show here. Shout out Scott Adams if you're listening.
Retweet this at Scott Adams. Yeah,
we'd love to have him on the show to talk about that, about Win Bigly and Loser Think, and get his take on crypto. That would be amazing. Thing is too, is like the media, almost no one trusts the media. It seemed like before, if you were, you know, it seems like it's become a wing of the Democratic Party, but even people on the left don't trust the media anymore. They see how blatantly biased they are, and it's not really objective. And with the money printer going burr, with the lockdowns, with the crazy COVID death predictions that haven't really panned out, a lot of people are asking questions. You mentioned Epstein. There's a pretty funny, I think, clip or article where someone asked Bill Gates, like, Bill, why were you on the Lolita Express like 5 or 6 times after Epstein was convicted? And he just like went silent. So people are asking these tough questions, and they're not just asking these tough questions to Trump. They're asking them to, you know, multi-billionaires, some of the strongest, most powerful people in the world. And I think those questions are questions worth asking, whether or not the people decide to answer them or not.
Well, yeah, that's true. And it's about time we have some sense of accountability for our so-called leaders, right? So Obama has had interference in foreign elections before. Well, in elections, he interfered with the Brexit election, coming over to the UK saying that if people did not vote to remain in the European Union, then the UK would have no chance of having a trade deal with the US. I mean, that was seen as like Obama trying to strong arm the UK into basically taking a globalist position. And let's not forget that the EU is completely unaccountable to the public. No one knows who, there's no process to elect the European president that involves the public. So it's kind of a farce, right? Everyone knows who the president of the United States is because there's a massive fanfare and there's like a 2-year-long election campaign where the public have to at least be entertained and engage with that process. And then by the end, the whole world knows who the president is. Who's the president of the EU? Tell me, Cade.
I
exactly. No one has a fucking clue. And that's because it's by design. The whole thing is set up to be like a technocrat's dream and a bureaucracy. Like anyone, people that even support the EU, you ask them who's the president of the EU, they don't know. They don't even know when the elections are. It's mental. Anyway,
yeah.
So
yeah, do you know who the president?
Around about politics all day.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know who the president of the moon is?
Who?
Blockade.
I like it. All right.
But we're having another election in 2 years. So if you want to take on blockade, you're gonna have to get on your spaceship, and we'll have a couple of debates. We'll live stream them. We'll beam them down to space. You guys can make your votes by proxy. But yeah, let's hop onto the blockchain here.
Yeah, we should. We've been going on politics too long. But if you guys like that type of content, me and Kate could go all day with that type of stuff. We've been keeping it on strictly blockchain stuff for the past 38 episodes. But if you guys like the taste of politics that we just gave you, then let us know. And we can, sprinkle that in here and there.
Yeah, we could do a little sidechain ourselves. We can make some episodes called Off the Blockchain, just talk about other stuff.
There we go.
But yeah, let's talk about what good news for Ethereum. So Vitalik says ETH 2.0 is still on track and they're progressing slowly but surely. It seems like they're being cautious. They've got some requirements like running a test net together for 2 months, and they're just trying to do some scaling stuff. So they're trying to reduce Oracle update latency by 37.5 times and transaction delay by 75 times. And theoretically, they could scale the throughput on both Ethereum 1.0 and 2.0 chains to over 1,000 transactions per second. So, for a while, I was a little skeptical on Ethereum being able to scale. There was a lot of FUD, it's going to be Cardano or EOS or one of these other blockchain projects, but it seems like they may be able to update without causing a lot of disruptions in the Ethereum and DeFi ecosystem. And I think that's huge because we've had a lot of DeFi guests on, and whether you think Ethereum is the best or not, no one wants it to fail because there's so much stuff tied up on the Ethereum blockchain with DeFi and MakerDAO and DAI and RDAI and all these other projects. So I think it's encouraging news if you're big into Ethereum in the DeFi space.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we need some kind of base layer infrastructure that is scalable. So if that means moving away from proof of work and towards proof of stake to achieve that, then that's fine. Of course, there are certain trade-offs that have to be made for that. I mean, some people say it can become a bit more like an oligarchy, or it can become entrenched. The people with power will remain in power because they will have the most Ethereum, so they'll be able to receive the most rewards for staking and so forth. So I can see that argument playing out as well. But in terms of reaching the masses, you need to have a scalability solution. So this is one of the pragmatic ways of achieving that. So Vitalik, good luck to you on Ethereum 2.0 that you've been talking about for a very long time. Let's hope that you actually deliver it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and we're wishing Ethereum and Vitalik all the best. And I'm big fans of Ethereum, also big fans of BTC and friends. And they were a little harsh on Vitalik in the last episode, but I thought it was pretty funny. And hopefully Vitalik has a thick skin and can take it.
Well, he probably has built up some immunity to memes and stuff. I mean, the amount of memes that guy's in now, he's got to have a thick skin, so fair play to him. I mean, he even had an ICO called Fit Vitalik, the ICO that was trying to make him healthy because he looks dangerously underweight. So, I'm sure he's by now quite happy to be the butt of jokes, considering he's a very wealthy individual now.
No.
Have you ever met Vitalik or seen him in real life, Kate? I'm just wondering.
No, I don't think so. I think he mostly talks at conferences that are focused on Ethereum. I don't know if I've ever been to like an Ethereum only kind of conference or an Ethereum focused conference. I kind of go to ones that are a little bit more distributed, I guess. But no, I haven't met him yet. How about yourself?
Well, I wouldn't like to say I've met him. Like, I'm not going to pretend that he's my friend or anything like that.
But you're in the audience fanboying for him?
I saw him at the Google studio in Seoul. And honestly, it was pretty disappointing because he basically made his presentation about this exact topic, about scaling Ethereum and going moving to proof of stake. And then, you know, you would like to be able to have a chance to, beyond a brief Q&A, actually talk to someone. He literally ran off as soon as he'd spoken. He literally ran out of the building and ran up the escalator, like literally running. So I was pretty disappointed by that. I thought, but then you can't blame him. Maybe he gets accosted wherever he goes. So yeah, that was a bit of a mixed reaction for
maybe
me.
Maybe nervous to socially interact, or maybe he just very busy schedule. You know, he's got to keep it going. Let's keep it going ourselves here. I want to talk about...
Hey, there's chicken and beer to eat in Seoul, you know?
Yeah. He probably... Or he had maybe. To go to... He was desperate to get some Korean barbecue. Who knows?
You never know.
Yeah, so let's keep it going here ourselves. So YouTube had canceled Cointelegraph's Bitcoin halving live stream for being harmful content. I don't really know what they said on the live stream, but I doubt it was harmful content. But they're notorious for deleting crypto content. And sure, there are some crypto scams asking you to like post like a QR code and like send one Bitcoin, you'll get five back, and things are obvious scams, but I really doubt Cointelegraph is doing that. They had almost 6 hours and 42 minutes of a, you know, a long live stream. It was almost done, and then they just deleted it and locked everyone out. They had like big guests like Roger Ver, Tim Draper, a bunch of others. And we've seen them do this to a lot of people. They've done it to Ivan on Tech. I think they did it to Data Dash. And that's one reason why Dark Side of the Hollow Moon is really no longer on YouTube. We stopped putting content there because of the algorithms, and because we don't want to put content out there and just have it get deleted later. So, you know, we're doing the podcast. We're on BitChute. We're probably going to be on Library. But, you know, other than posting a farewell video on YouTube and why we're not there, that could maybe be our first YouTube exclusive saying goodbye to YouTube. You know, I just don't really want to be there and support people that are, you know, censoring crypto stuff. They're censoring stuff that's questioning the pandemic. They're censoring all kinds of political stuff. And it's just not a place I want to be. And I'm trying to get off of even on going on YouTube to watch. If a person has an alternate channel somewhere else, I try and watch it there and not support them.
Well, that's a good thing to do from a moral perspective. It seems that most people these days, young people, watch YouTube instead of watching TV. And I think that the big conglomerates, they've become aware over the past few years that normal mainstream media has lost its power. So they've kind of, behind the scenes, definitely lobbied some of the big social media channels that are out there, social media platforms. I wouldn't be surprised if we see more censorship on things like YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc. But for 99% of people that are not awake, not bothered about most things, then life will go on as normal. But for us, we have to... we have to put our content out where people are going to be able to find it. And it's not very good to basically put out the same content on YouTube that in theory has like 100 times the audience of BitChute, but then to see BitChute have like 10 or 20x the response and engagement rate. So there's definitely something up with the YouTube algorithm. I wouldn't be surprised if there has been some high-level talks, let's put it like that, with executives at the company saying, let's rein it in over here and let's control the dialect a little bit. But that's a dangerous thing in a democracy. It's very important that you have the ability to express yourself. Now, at the same time, though, people say, well, they're private companies, so private companies have the right to refuse service. That's also true. And we as customers, and we as clients, we also have the right to take our business and our content elsewhere. So yeah, I think that's what we have to do.
Well, that's a, I mean, we could talk about too. Like, are they just distributing content, or are they a publisher that has to vouch for their content? They can either be a free speech platform, or they can be a publisher. They can't be both. But actually, I think Alphabet, who owns both Google and YouTube, I think they're actually running YouTube at a loss. So it seems like they're almost using it as a way to influence, you know, politics and influence things and in direction they want to influence things.
I would love to see the numbers on that. I'd be surprised if it's running at a loss. Maybe it might be running at a loss in certain countries, but I'm sure overall it's making money. Or maybe it's just a massive funnel into the Google ecosystem in general. But Google's business model is essentially all about advertisements. Like 85%, 90% of the revenue is coming from ads that are served to people using different Google platforms, including YouTube, but also Gmail, also like AdWords, AdSense, that type of thing. So all of that is interesting to me, having a marketing business background. So let me know about that. Send me a link sometime later on.
Yeah, I will. All right, let's go to the next one. So Cambridge University has released a new tool for tracking global Bitcoin mining power. And I'm not really sure how they're doing that. And they mentioned that actually a lot of mining pools, especially in China, they use VPNs to mask their IP addresses. So they've been able to do a little internet sleuthing and kind of figure out in a more accurate way where the mining is happening. And I mean, almost everyone knows most of the mining is happening in China, or a lot of it's happening in China. I think now it's over 50%, but they're also being able to break it down by province and see how it changes when it's the wet season. They're using a lot more hydropower. So I think it's just another cool, interesting tool and something that people should know about, especially if you're in the mining community.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting to see this, actually. I'm looking on the site and China, 65% of the mining power is in China. Only 7% in the United States is number two. Then Russia, Kazakhstan, Malaysia, very close behind the United States. So, yeah, I mean, China has basically a monopoly on the hash power. And, you know, in theory, 51% attack. Well, we're at 65%. So should the Chinese government say, do the things to the people that own the mining rigs, then you could see some pretty funky stuff happening on Bitcoin, on the BTC public ledger. So be aware of that. That's very important to be aware of. And I think that having open source information like this is pretty vital, especially when it comes from a world-class university like the University of Cambridge, which you can actually trust. So I'd be interested to see how this progresses, but it's not very good news, in my opinion, to see that 65% of the mining power is in China. I knew that most of it was in China, or the largest pools were from China. I didn't know that it was literally 10x, well, it's like 8x bigger than the United States' share, and there's no one even close in terms of mining power.
So I was originally...
It's not a good idea then, really, if you think about it. Why would you want BTC being the global ledger if the Chinese miners can manipulate it? I don't really get it now.
Well, I was worried about it too, but I've listened to some other really smart people talk about it and what they could possibly do if they controlled all of it. The thing is, this mining is all in different provinces. They're all in different mining pools. Some of them are like in the middle of the forest, you know, running on hydropower. So
that doesn't matter. If the CCP says, hello, mining people, we're taking all of your rigs, then there's nothing stopping the CCP doing that, actually. They could do that. They could be planning stuff. They could plan it in secret for a few weeks, literally take over the stuff the next day and do all sorts of stuff. So it's pretty worrying to see this, in my opinion.
Well, apparently people have talked about, too, like if they did try and do a chain reorg within one or two blocks, people would be able to notice it and do something about it. But yeah, I think, of course, no one's going to say that it's ideal to have, you know, 65% in China, and hopefully we'll see it more distributed throughout the world. Let's talk a little bit about, speaking of Bitcoin, let's talk a little bit about investing. So, you know, we've had a lot of big investors say Bitcoin's a scam, they're never going to invest in it. We've got some different news today. So hedge fund pioneer Paul Tudor Jones says he holds 1-2% of his assets in Bitcoin. And if you don't know, he's very well known. And he manages, I believe, still a very large fund. And he's not 100% banking on it, but at least he's being reasonable. You know, he sees its potential. He sees the use case. He sees the market cap. You know, he's not all in, but, you know, some people stay having 1-2% in. You know, they affectionately call it idiot insurance. You know, like, even if you think you're wrong, it's good to have 1-2% in case you're wrong about Bitcoin not being anything, you know?
Well, yeah, for him, I mean, he manages a $5 billion fund. So if he puts in 1%, we're looking at like, what, $50 million? That's quite a lot of coins right there.
Actually, he manages a fund that's $22 billion, I believe, according.
Well, it depends which source you look at, I guess. I just read it on Wikipedia with my Googling skills right here. So it depends on which source.
He also runs the BVI Global Fund. That's $22 billion, I believe. But yeah, he's whatever it is, it's billions BVI and billions of dollars.
Like, it sounds like the British Virgin Islands. So he's in the tax havens. He knows what he's doing with his money. Very good. But if he's got 1-2% of his funds in there and he's advising his clients to do the same thing, then that's going to be an awful lot of money going into BTC. It's going to also help affect the price because demand and supply. Well, this could be a good juncture to talk about that, actually, Cade, a little bit. At the start of this show, I alluded to the fact that I think we're going to make a price prediction. It is the 14th of May right now as we record it. Hopefully, we get this out in the next few days. I reckon in about 30 days, so let's call it the middle of June, we're going to see a doubling in the price. We're going to be nearly at an all-time high, if not surpassed. So I think we can see Bitcoin at 20 million Korean won, because that's where I am and that's where I trade on the Korean sites. I think that's around 18,000 US dollars. Let's see if I'm wrong or not on that one. But there's basically nothing stopping it right now. There's no news to propel it. There's no bad news to stop it. Except if people listen to this and they find out the Chinese miners control most of the network.
Yeah, well, we'll have to check in a month. And if you're right, or if your truthiness pretty close to right, we'll have to retweet it out. If not, we'll stealthily edit it out of the episode like it never happened, George Orwell style.
Yeah, we'll do it like CNN style. We'll just pretend it never happened.
Goes down the memory hole.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of going from one investor to another, let's talk about Max Keiser basically saying that Warren Buffett really killed his reputation by not even considering Bitcoin. And honestly, he still doesn't seem to even understand it. And not only is he not in Bitcoin, but he's actually made some pretty big mistakes. He lost $50 billion in Q1, in quarter one. And now, basically, it looks like with what he's managing, he's got almost all of it, or a lot of it, in cash. He's got $137 billion in cash and equivalent instruments. So he's not invested in crypto or gold or stocks or really anything. He's just on the sidelines holding cash, waiting. So I don't know what he's waiting for, but I think he's right. You know, with every year, you know, people keep saying Bitcoin's going to die. And every year, it seems like the market cap gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And at one point, everyone's going to flip and everyone's going to be like, of course, you know, we're going to see the flippening when it comes to people's mindset about Bitcoin and crypto. And, you know, I think older people, it's kind of hard to change. You know, some, you know, I know older people that don't have an email address and they never will. They refuse to. And it seems like he might kind of be one of those people who's never even going to look into it. And I would say, just like the previous guy, even if he thinks it's a complete scam, put in 0.5%, put in 0.33%, put something into it. But to just be sitting on the sidelines with cash, you know, when the money printer is going burr and the stock market is looking a little shaky, honestly, like, obviously is a very intelligent guy, but sometimes you have intellectual blind spots or things you don't look at. So I think he is damaging his reputation. You know, every year he waits for it. What do you think?
Well, I don't think he should care about that at this point in his life. He's quite old. He's made a lot of money. He is the most successful investor in history. And he's influential for that reason alone, really. The fact that he's managed a huge fund, Berkshire Hathaway, for a long time, made a lot of money. So, look, this might be a transition period. This might be a crossing over from one generation to the other. But at the same time, you can't write off experience. I think that cash is king in some respects. Obviously, the money printer has gone burr a lot. Maybe that's why he has gone into more of a liquid asset, like, let's say, cash, because then he can pounce on things that he thinks are going to be undervalued in the this aftermath of what's happened with the coronavirus. So I'm sure he's looking carefully at undervalued stocks using his intelligent investor model from Benjamin Graham, and he's looking at things that that can go into the future. But he's pretty old, so also habits are pretty difficult to break, honestly. So he's gone into the same office every day and read like different books all the time. So I can't really blame him. I wouldn't say that he's ruined his reputation. I'm sure that Max Keiser is big in his own world, in his own sphere, but like he is completely dwarfed by the achievements of Warren Buffett. So I'd rather err on the side of giving Warren Buffett his due and saying, fair enough, Warren, this might be your, you know, one of your last big plays or whatever before you go out there. I just wish you'd just retire and take it easy, because get your cherry Coke, get your Coca-Cola, enjoy yourself, and have your hamburger. That's what he likes.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. You know, sometimes I seem to be like a factional crypto warrior. I like to, you know, sometimes attack people who don't like crypto. But yeah, I think live and let live. Buy crypto or don't. Hold your private keys or don't. You know, live your life. But he is pretty old, and I think he still lives in the same small house he had before. He doesn't really like use his wealth. I think he just drives an old car, lives in a tiny house. He's not driving Lambos all over the place, which is something I respect.
Exactly. Well, he understands the value of money. You know, there are a lot of people that actually know the price of everything but the value of nothing, and he's the one who actually understands the value of money and the value of life. So like, he's lived in the same house, drives the same car, married and been with the same woman his whole life. He understands things that bring you long-term satisfaction. He's not a hedonist. He's definitely someone that people should aspire to be like. It doesn't mean that everything he says is perfect, though. So I'm in your camp when it comes to him being wrong about crypto. He should hedge his bets a little bit, put a few percent of his portfolio into crypto, just as a hedge against inflation and things of that nature. But he's the wealthiest investor that's ever lived, so I'd rather not be talking shit about him. I'd just rather say, yeah, I could learn a lot from him. And he's made a few like mistakes in his past, and he's basically admitted that he didn't invest in any of the big tech companies, really. He's never really been a fan of the tech companies, because let's be honest, in general, in the tech sector, a lot of the valuations are completely bananas and mental anyway. I mean, you can look at a few of the success stories, but then for every success story, there are, well, that's what VC funds invest in. They invest in like 10 projects to hope that one of them moons, and the 9 that die basically recoup the losses well, the 9 that die get all of those losses get recovered by the one that moons, right? So in general, the tech sector is full of these massive disasters. So maybe that's why he's very cautious about it. But anyway, who knows what he really thinks? We'll have to get him on the show one day. Warren, we'll see you next week on the Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about Bitcoin as a store of value. And there's recently some interesting reports and some analysis coming out. And one thing that I read, it was from Coinbase, wrote about it, is that Bitcoin's global mining ecosystem seems resilient, you know, whereas the gold refineries, miners, and supply chains have been disrupted because of the coronavirus pandemic. So it's been resilient. And also because of the halvening, which just recently happened, you know, now Bitcoin's on par with gold's historic scarcity. So although gold still rules and crypto's a lot more volatile, we are seeing that trend towards Bitcoin as a store of value. And then at the end of this article, it also mentions gold in crypto form, gold-backed stablecoins. And, you know, we've had some people say those are good or bad. Matthew, one of our previous guests, said that, you know, he thought that might be interesting. And actually, one of our recent interviews, Roger Ver, mentioned they've already tried it with e-gold, something similar. And actually, the U.S. government confiscated all the gold. So that's the one big downside of having gold-backed stablecoins. You still need a vault somewhere, and you still need to be able to trust them. And also, like you mentioned with China taking over the miners, if the government decides we're going after the gold vault, it's going to be pretty hard to stop them.
Yeah, man. So on that one, you nailed all the points there. I think you're right. It's going to be pretty difficult to level that one out. Let's look at the next thing that we want to talk about today, which is going to be the stock to flow.
Yeah. Before we do that, though, what do you think of gold-backed stablecoins? I haven't really gotten your take on it before. Do you? Are you hot on them? Don't really care? Think they're
Like gold-pegged coins? Coins that are pegged to the price of gold? In theory, I don't think that's a bad idea. I mean, it just replaces what Peter Schiff does with his product. Instead of it being his company that does it, you just basically would buy a digital asset that is pegged to the price of gold. I don't really mind that at all. It would make it easier to buy and sell, especially if you could do it in a decentralized way. But then again, it comes down to the issue of trust, the issuing party, the company behind it. Because although Bitcoin is decentralized and it has, you know, a distributed network of miners that are doing these things, some more heavily located in geographical areas than others. But the fact is, it still often depends on the trust of the company itself. So it goes back to like the sandwich problem that I've talked about previously, which is you still need to trust the people that are behind the blockchain network to input the actual factual information into the network. When it comes with BTC, which is just a record of transactions of Bitcoin between different parties that own Bitcoin wallets, then that's pretty easy. But when it comes to having a real world tangible good that is then associated with something which is a digital ledger of that physical good, then you basically have to trust the third party that is the one signing the transaction into the digital ledger. And that's where the slippery slope comes in, because you don't necessarily know that the company that is saying, yeah, all the gold is there, is legit or not, right? So this is the problem that arises when you have anything physical in a cryptocurrency or blockchain system. So blockchain is very good when it comes to digital transactions and anything that doesn't have to involve anything physical or any other third party. As soon as you involve a third party and you have an additional asset like gold added into the mix, you're then just adding in another party that you have to trust, and then therefore it devalues the whole point of the blockchain system. I hope that makes complete sense, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's my thoughts on it.
That's why I'm not a really big fan of it.
Yeah, I tend to agree. You know, that's the whole point of Bitcoin is Bitcoin is the asset. So let's go to that next article you want to talk about. So Plan B, he's written some pretty well-known articles price predictions about Bitcoin. He has a new one. It's Bitcoin stock to flow cross asset model. And not only does he have a lot of charts, if you're a chart reader, but he also talks about phase transitions. He gives the example of water being a phase from solid to liquid to gas or ionized, or the dollar transitioning from gold to silver to just a fiat currency. And you can read it yourself, but I kind of want to talk a little bit about what he says there. He says that he kind of predicts $288,000 Bitcoin, and he basically says if that happens, the world's going to get nasty. And he says that he's going to go dark. He's going to go off the grid if it becomes successful, because it'll not be a pretty picture. He says, I'm going to quote here, it'll be nasty. It'll be major war. People have Bitcoin. Some people don't have Bitcoin. It'll be some countries have Bitcoin. Some won't have Bitcoins. It will be the U.S. dollar losing its reserve status. It will be geopolitical. It'll be military. So, you know, for me, I think like if Bitcoin or gold or something doesn't fix this financial clown world, it's going to get nasty. We're going to have worldwide hyperinflation. So I think like Bitcoin or gold, going back to a gold standard or something, is the cure. But he's saying if Bitcoin goes up, it's also going to be nasty. So, you
know, it just makes sense. It makes total sense, right? Because we've just talked about China having 65% of the mining power, China and the US gearing up to basically, they're already in some type of a cyber war right now. They're in a meme war against each other. Obviously, a hot war would be a disaster, so that's not going to necessarily happen. However, this is a war of attrition between the two mindsets of how to run a society, and it's not going to end very quickly, that particular thing. And then let's play this into this stock-to-flow thing that Plan B is talking about. If Bitcoin does actually become as highly valued as it is, then the issue will be the dollar status will be undermined because they've frankly printed too many dollars. But also, Bitcoin network can never fully be trusted because the Chinese are basically in control of it. And then it becomes this big, showdown between these two sides, which is there are some well-intentioned people that want to believe that BTC is the decentralized future. But the reality is most of the mining power is in China. And then you've got the US patriots, the guys that want the freedom to run. Who knows? They're not really big fans of that. But then they don't like all of the money printing that's gone on. Then you've got the average people in the middle classes, that completely clueless about all this stuff. And they just see their standard of living decreasing, the cost of living going up, and their purchasing power going way down. It could be super messy. And then you've got Bitcoin, you're a bad person. In America, you're like, oh, you must support China. If you're Chinese, it's going to be like, it's mental.
Let me push back on that a little bit. So, one thing we mentioned before earlier is that, yeah, China has a lot of the mining, and America is second, and also a lot of investors hold a lot of Bitcoin. But I think if it transitions towards that store of value and it kind of looks like it's going that way, don't you think other countries would adjust? Don't you think they'd increase mining power in the U.S.? Or, you know, we don't hardly see any mining in Europe or South America or Africa. Don't you think other countries would start mining, even South Korea or Japan or Australia? Don't you think we'd try and see mining kind of be distributed more? We're seeing like some interesting Bitcoin mining in like Iceland and the Nordic countries with cheap power. Don't you think that we'd see an adjustment if people thought like Bitcoin was going to be the reserve currency? And if not, if there was like some sort of Chinese takeover, it would, like, Bitcoin would be destroyed and it would have to be something else.
Well, maybe. We'll have to see. I mean, the only prediction I can make for this show is going to be 20K BTC in around a month.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we'd see like a block reorg. I don't think China would do that. That's just my opinion. But I think if you say that it's going to be nasty, I think we'd see kind of like a bipolar world. We'd just see, China and the U.S. holding a lot of Bitcoin and not a lot of Bitcoin from other countries holding it. So let's go to the next article and let's talk about peer-to-peer crypto usage in Australia. So CoinSpice wrote a pretty good article about Bitcoin's retail usage. There's only 3 transactions recorded in the entire country for the month. And actually, Bitcoin Cash had 97% of the transactions. And all these other ones had 0 transactions. Dash, BSV, Litecoin, Ethereum, BNB, LN. I think that's Lightning Network. So it does seem like when it comes to peer-to-peer cash, which you know I'm a big fan of, it seems like BCH has really taken over Australia. And I think it's an interesting sign and something interesting happening in the land of kangaroos.
Well, talking about the land of kangaroos, there's a certain guy who graduated from Charles Sturt University in 2017. He achieved his PhD, and his doctoral thesis was called The Quantification of Information Systems Risk, a look at quantitative responses to information security issues. However, this certain individual, Craig Wright, has been outed for plagiarism. Now, here's the thing. It's one chapter was plagiarized, which is never good. What do you think about this, Cade? This new response from, well, I don't know who posted it. Painted Frog on Medium posted this. But I think it's really damaging for Craig Wright. It's really damaging for BSV, and it doesn't bode well.
Yeah, well, basically, you know, whether you love him or hate him, and most people seem to hate him, I'm not a big fan myself. It seems like just the negative things we hear about him just keep piling up. And, you know, you don't always want to trust the consensus opinion or the majority opinion, but basically it looks like he just basically copied and pasted things and put them in his thesis. And the only thing he did to try and hide it is he just changed a few words in the sentences. They added some different synonyms and changed the wording around a little bit just to make it a little bit harder to detect, but it's pretty blatant and pretty clear. And I think it's the evidence is pretty strong.
Well, yeah, the Tulip Fund thing in January, February did work out. I mean, BSV was about $80, and then it pumped to like $400 around that time. But now it's pretty steady. I think the project is kind of going to be looked at as a joke now. It's obvious he's not Satoshi. It's obvious that he's a bit of a fraud. It's a bit of a shame that it's turned out this way. But, Cade, I've got to tell you honestly, it's time to wrap this show up because I've been on the dark side of Hodl Moon too long today, and it's time to call this a crypto currently for May 2020.
All right, yeah, let's wrap it up. There's just one more thing I want to mention, and that is that Blockstream has a satellite network that's 25 times faster. And now you're going to be able to sync your Bitcoin full node from the satellite network. You're going to be able to download the entire Bitcoin blockchain from space, from the Genesis block up to today with no internet required. So in some ways, I'm not a big fan of Blockstream, but I thought this was pretty cool. And people are always wondering, what if the internet's down? Well, we're going to have satellites. We're going to transmit cryptocurrency through radio waves, and we're going to have these other methods of doing it. And although I'm not a big fan of Blockstream in some other ways, you got to give credit where credit is due. I thought it was pretty cool. And yeah, we're seeing some other companies putting like nodes and stuff in space. So I think it's pretty cool that we're seeing crypto, you know, outside of Earth in orbit. And, you know, we have some interesting crypto node stuff happening on the dark side of the Hodl Moon as well. So I think that's a great way to wrap it up. And that will do it for us today. I'm Blockade with Josh, and we'll see you next month for next month's Crypto Currently on the dark side of the Hodl Moon.
Thank you for joining us on Dark Side of the Hodl Moon. If you haven't already subscribed, please do so. Also, be sure to join our Telegram group, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and follow us on BitChute and YouTube, where you can find all the episodes as well as highlights from previous episodes. You can also visit us at darksideofthehodlmoon.com. Hodl Moon!